Numbers chapter 6. We looked at 1 through 5 last time. Numbers 6, the first four chapters identify Israel's organization. And chapter 5 kind of picks up all the way through chapter 10 with speaking about Israel's sanctification, getting them separated and then preparing them until the point when they're going to start their journeys. The first 10 chapters basically have to do with just a short period of time, and the rest of the book of Numbers covers about 39 years of their history. So it's very important that the Lord organize them, but from our standpoint, it's a little difficult to say, okay, I can really use that in my morning devotion, and there's something I can get out of here, but we'll see what the Holy Spirit has for us. In chapter 6, the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when either a man or a woman consecrates an offering to take the vow of a Nazarite to separate himself to the Lord, he shall separate himself from wine and similar drink and drink neither vinegar made from wine nor vinegar made from similar drink. Neither shall he drink any grape juice nor eat fresh grapes or raisins. All the days of his separation he shall eat nothing that is produced by the grapevine from seed to skin. And all the days of his vow, or the vow of his separation, no razor shall come upon his head until the days are fulfilled for which he separated himself to the Lord. He shall be holy. Then he shall let the locks of his hair of his head grow. And all the days he separates himself to the Lord, he shall not go near a dead body, nor shall he even make himself unclean for his father or mother, for his brother or sister when they die, because his separation to God is on his head. All the days of his separation, he shall be holy to the Lord." Now this first picture here is this vow of a Nazarite. Now, it was a willing vow. It wasn't something the Lord required of anyone. It was something they themselves would go, I really want to separate myself unto the Lord for a period of time. And so it was an exceptional vow of consecration, of unusual devotion to the Lord, not to be confused with being like Jesus of Nazarene. Nazareth and Nazarite vow are two totally different verbs. And so it's a totally different picture. Now, we often look at some of the prohibitions in Scripture, and I want to remind you of this. As we go through all these laws, you get the feeling that, wow, it's, don't. And the idea of there's so many things that can defile you. But remember, when the Lord speaks about being separated from things in the world, He's often wants us to have a greater picture of the positive aspect of that. He doesn't want us to be separated so much from the world as much as He wants us to be separated unto Him. And if you're concentrating on the negative, what I can't do, especially if you were in those days and you were to take a vow of a Nazarite and think about, the main three things that you can't do, no wine or anything that comes from the grapevine, no haircuts, and no contamination with the dead bodies. And if you constantly thought about that, you'd be conscious of just what you couldn't do rather than realizing that the Lord was drawing you apart for Himself for a period of time. Now, we know of a famous person who took the vow of a Nazarite. Actually, he was committed from his mother to take the vow of a Nazarite. So it really wasn't even his choice. His parents started it for him, and then he followed through. Of course, we also know him as the greatest failure in this aspect by the name of Samson. And we're all familiar, perhaps, with the story of Samson and Delilah. The mistake we make, however, is thinking that Samson's great strength comes from his hair. That seems to be what the story implies, and that seems to be what, anytime you see a movie about it, it was the strength was in his hair, and his hair got clipped, that's it. He lost his strength. And when his hair grew again, then he got his strength back. But all that symbolized, really, was his devotion and being consecrated unto the Lord. He had violated, actually, a number of these things. We don't know about the grapevine products, but he did contaminate himself with a dead carcass of a lion, and he was not faithful in this area. He also certainly had loose morals. However, one of the things that you notice in the prohibitions, kind of amazing, it's sexual enjoyment with wife or husband is not prohibited. And the idea here is that celibacy wasn't supposed to be something that was more spiritual, of course, unless you're not married. And celibacy is kind of incumbent upon you till you get married. But the idea here is Samson is the great failure in this area. He was faithful, but he began to play very fast and loose with his commitment with the Lord. He began compromising in a little bit here and a little bit there. And eventually what happened is when he was in a tough spot, he shared all that was in his heart to Delilah, you know, after playing a few games with her, getting dangerously close by saying, yeah, if you just weave my locks of my hair in a certain way, then I'll lose my strength. But then finally he told her, you know, if you cut my hair, I'm a Nazarite, I can't do that. And he basically turned his strength over to the Lord. Now the hair cutting was just the picture of the consecration which he violated. So this is the vow of a Nazarite. And verse 9, he says, if anyone dies suddenly. Now notice the commitment. Even a Levite was required to not touch a dead body. But if the father or mother of a Levite died, or a priest died, then he could defile himself on their behalf. Because, I mean, a natural affection and close relative and taking care of their body and then realizing he had to be separated for a time. But a person who took a Nazarite vow couldn't even touch themselves for their father and their mother. It was a very serious vow. But verse 9 says, if anyone dies very suddenly beside him and defiles his consecrated head, then he'll shave his head on the day of his cleansing. The seventh day he'll shave it. And the eighth day he'll bring two turtle doves, two young pigeons to the priest at the door of the tabernacle of meeting. And it describes a number of the many offerings that we already looked at as to the priest offering one as a sin offering, a burnt offering, and by reason of the fact he touched and defiled himself with a dead body. In verse 12, it says he'll consecrate to the Lord of the days of his separation and bring a male lamb in the first year as a trespass offering, but the former days shall be lost because his separation was defiled. This is the law of the Nazarite. When the days of his separation are fulfilled, he'll be brought to the door of the tabernacle of meeting. So now it's only a particular period of time where Samson was a Nazarite from birth. This could be a vow that you could say, I'm going to separate myself for a month, a year, 2 years, 5 years, whatever you would want to do. And when your day was complete, then you bring in the offering, verse 14, to the Lord, one male lamb its first year without blemish, as a burnt offering, one ewe lamb in its first year without blemish as a sin offering, and one ram without blemish as a peace offering. So lifting up the various offerings that were there. Now, I see such a repetition within these offerings. I am tempted to keep moving when I look at some of them so that we can get to some of the points of it, because we notice that every detail of defilement required a sacrifice, whether it's a peace offering, a sin offering, or a burnt offering. And the priest, verse 16, brings them before the Lord to offer his sin offering, the burnt offering, and he offers the ram. And we go on. The Nazarite, verse 18, would shave his consecrated head and take the hair from his consecrated head and put it on the fire, which is under the sacrifice. So he can't even hold it for a trophy and put it in a jar and, you know, remind himself, look what the vow that I took. It was all to the Lord. The priest shall take the boiled shoulder of the ram, verse 19, one unleavened cake from the basket, one unleavened wafer, and put them upon the hands of the Nazarite after he has shaved his consecrated hair. And the priest shall wave them as a wave offering before the Lord. They are holy for the priest, together with the breast of the wave offering and the thigh of the heave offering. After that, the Nazarite may drink wine. So he's completed his offerings, his period of time of separation, and then he can go back to a normal lifestyle in that economy. This is the law of the Nazarite, who vows to the Lord the offering for a separation, and beside that, whatever else his hand is able to provide, according to the vow which he takes. So he must do according to the law of the separation. So if you're going to do it, you got to do it according to the prescription. If you're not going to do it, then there's no requirement that you do it. But this gives the picture here. And the remainder of this chapter gives the blessing of Aaron. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to Aaron and his sons, saying, this is the way you shall bless the children of Israel. Say to them, the Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace. Now, this has been called the Lord's Prayer of the Old Testament. God desiring to bless his people. Remember when the disciples wondered, how do we pray? Came to Jesus, and Jesus said, pray in this manner. And he gave them kind of a picture, and a model prayer. We call it the Lord's Prayer, but in reality, he was giving it to the disciples. The Lord's Prayer, I look at, is John 17, when Jesus interceded for, you know, his people. But that particular prayer in Luke, where Jesus says, you know, this is what you should say, our Father which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. And expressing that example or that model to the disciples. This has been called the Lord's Prayer of the Old Testament. Here the language is very poetic. There are three lines with God's name in each one of the lines. The repetition of the name of God is fitting because you've got the Trinity here. You know, three times the name of the Lord is mentioned. The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make His face to shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up His countenance to you and give you peace. And each line conveys two aspects of prayer. And kind of a fascinating thing is if you don't count the threefold use of the name of God, there's a total of 12 Hebrew words in this entire prayer. And it's symbolic there of the 12 tribes of Israel. And the Lord making His name, really, as He prays that they'd be blessed and preserved, the face shine upon you. The idea is their blessing is tied to the name of the Lord. Anytime you're reading in Scripture about the name of the Lord, realize that it's not just mentioning His name that really means something. Names had weight. When you gave your children a name, it had something to do with their character or the nature of the birth. Names meant something. They were very important. And even when Moses cried to the Lord and said, "Lord, show me your glory," when the Lord put him in the cleft of the rock and passed by, what he did was he proclaimed the name of the Lord to Moses. He proclaimed His name. When Jesus tells us as His disciples to pray in His name, and whatever you ask in His name, in My name, Jesus said, that I will give to you. Now, what is being said there? Does that mean that you just tag at the end of your prayer in Jesus' name and it kind of becomes a magic type of a blessing? You know, that's all you have to say and you got the right formula, so therefore now God is going to answer your prayer. Or is that something a little more than that? I'd submit to you that when you pray in Jesus' name, you're praying in all of His character and His nature. So any prayer that would be a prayer outside of His character or nature certainly would not be according to His name, even if you did use His name. And if you used His name for a prayer that was outside of His character, then you'd be using His name in vain. And you'd be taking His name in vain. We often associate taking the name of the Lord's name in vain. You know, if someone's down at the shop, you know, and he's cursing, using, the name of the Lord in some type of a curse, that's using His name. That certainly is in vain. But primarily when the Lord speaks about using His name in vain, I feel He is saying that of all His character and of His nature that He desires us to be a part of, He wants that to be a part of us, when we use His name for other than really walking with Him and going in the place where we're consecrated unto Him, we're really using His name in vain. So the name, blessing upon Israel, wrapped up entirely in the name of the Lord, a very important concept. Now we come to chapter 7, and we come to the various offerings that are brought by the leaders of Israel. Now the leaders were mentioned, their names which I did not pronounce in chapter 1, and I'm not going to try to pronounce them in this chapter either. But these guys were the leaders of the various tribes, the 12 tribes, and basically they're going to bring the various offerings unto Moses to perform for the work of the service of the tabernacle. And it came to pass, verse 1, that Moses had finished setting up the tabernacle, that he anointed it and sanctified it, and all its furnishings, and the altar, and all its utensils. So he anointed them and sanctified them. And the leaders of Israel, the heads of their fathers' houses, who were the leaders of the tribes and over those who were numbered, made an offering. And they brought their offering before the Lord, 6 covered carts and 12 oxen, a cart for every 2 of the leaders and for every 1 ox, or every each one an ox. And they presented them before the tabernacle. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Accept these from them, that they may be used in doing the work of the tabernacle of meeting, and you shall give them to the Levites, to every man according to his service." So Moses then took the carts and the oxen and gave them to the Levites. 2 carts, 4 oxen he gave to the sons of Gershon. 4 carts and 8 oxen he gave to the sons of Merari, according to their service, under the hand of Ithamar, the son of Aaron. But to the sons of Kohath he gave none, because theirs was the service of the holy things which they carried on their shoulders. So the Gershonites, they carried the coverings, the curtains, and all that sort of thing. So they got 2 carts. But the guys who had the heaviest load, all the timbers and the sockets of silver and gold and brass, they were carrying the heavy stuff, so they got the most carts. The Kohathites got none because they had the implements or the furniture inside, and everything in the inside was to be borne by hand, not on a cart. In fact, later on in the history of Israel, David learns a very important lesson. because of they're not reading the scriptures and how the ark was to be handled. When they capture it back from the Philistines, David eventually brings it up from the house of the man who'd had it in his home for some time, for 20 years from the time of Saul. And there's a great party. They put it on a cart, however. And they're carrying it up on a cart, and they're rejoicing and having a great time because the ark of God is coming back, you know, into the land of Israel, and it's going to be represented as now the Lord is going to be the center. But because it's on a cart, it starts to tip when the oxen stumbled, and Uzzah reaches out to try to steady it, and instantly he's dead. The Lord smites him. David is shocked. The people are shocked. Their party turns into mourning. They don't know what's going on. And David eventually goes back. He's a little upset, but he reads the scriptures. He finds out that he handled it totally wrong. That was not to be carried on a cart. And he learns a very important lesson, and eventually he brings the ark back up, how it was to be carried, and the Lord blessed and honored that particular thing. To us, that seems pretty heavy, but it was a very important object lesson. You can't just handle the things of God any old way. God is holy. He is separate. We have to be careful, even as Christians, I think. We live in such incredible grace. The Lord is so patient. We hear promises, even when we're unfaithful, the Lord abides faithful, and that's certainly true. But we have to continue to stretch our hearts and our minds in the holiness of God. He has not come down to our level. He has not condescended to us as Jesus did, only to live on our level, but rather He reached down to us so that He might pull us up to walk with Him, that He might create more in us a heart of holiness and separateness unto Him, and desiring that we would live and walk worthy of the calling with which He's called us. So that's an important thing, and we just got off on that whole concept of the carts because they're now giving them to Moses for this service. Then the leaders offered the dedication offering for the altar. So they each brought from their tribes various offerings to dedicate for this tabernacle when it was anointed. So the leaders offered their offering before the altar. And the Lord said to Moses, "They shall offer their offering 1 liter each day for the dedication of the altar." And the one who offered his offering on the first day was Nashon, the son of Mimmadab. And from the tribe of Judah, his offering was 1 silver platter, the weight of which was 130 shekels, 1 silver bowl of 70 shekels, according to the shekel of the sanctuary, both of them full of fine flour mixed with oil as a grain offering, 1 gold pan of 10 shekels full of incense, and 1 young bull, 1 ram, and 1 male in its first year, male lamb in its first year, as a burnt offering, 1 kid of the goats as a sin offering, and for the sacrifice of peace offerings, 2 oxen, 5 rams, 5 male goats, and 5 male lambs in their first year. This was the offering of Nashon, the son of Minadab. Now, on the second day, we see the same thing. Nethiel, the son of leader of the tribe of Issachar, and it's the exact same offering. So I am not going to labor through reading it again, especially I'm not going to read through it 12 times. And I laugh because, you know, when you see this on paper, you wonder, well, Lord, why did you repeat the exact same offering that every one of these guys brought? And I realized, you know, it's kind of like when you go to graduation and you hear the same thing being pronounced over each of the persons that are graduating. It's a ceremony. And you don't get the picture when you're reading it on paper, the ceremony thing happening, you know, before your eyes. And each of them bring it up and they present it and the record of it is given and it's a rejoicing. The next guy comes the next day. And really, it's a ceremonial thing, but for the ceremony, we're going to skip to we'll pick up at verse 84 as he concludes these various offerings, of which each of these guys bring exactly the same thing to offer unto the Lord. So it's a worthy remark in this respect that though they're bringing the same thing, the idea is that they all had an equality there before the Lord. And it's also something that each of them are bringing the offering in the same order in which they're camped around the tabernacle and in which they're also going to travel. So that's just a piece of trivia that might bless you and it might not. But let's pick up in verse 84. This was the dedication offering for the altar from the leaders of Israel when it was anointed, 12 silver platters, 12 silver bowls, 12 gold pans. And so on and on. He basically everything is in 12s of what he described. And verse 89 then says, "Now when Moses went into the tabernacle of meeting to speak with him, he heard the voice of one speaking to him from above the mercy seat that was on the ark of the testimony, from between the two cherubim, thus he spoke to him." So this picture of the Lord, now Moses went into the tabernacle. These offerings have been given, and he went in to speak with him. Now, just picture the solemnness of this occasion. After the 12 days of these people bringing their offerings, and this tabernacle is completed, of which they've put all their heart and their soul into constructing it. And they're anticipating this one thing, that the Lord's presence will dwell with them. So Moses goes in, and he speaks with God. Not as God speaks with prophets, but in a way, face-to-face, although not the same face-to-face that you would think of in, you know, confronting God in a physical form. As best as it could be described, Moses was speaking with him, and he heard the voice of one speaking to him from above the mercy seat that was on the Ark of the Testimony. So the Lord said, "I want to dwell with you," and this is how it's going to happen. When all these sacrifices are done just so, when all the instructions for the tabernacle are just so, then the Lord is able then to meet with them between the cherubim on the mercy seat above the Ark of the Covenant. Sometimes we sing the song, you know, between the cherubim, we're meeting with the Lord. And this is the whole concept of that. This is where the Jewish people had the awareness that the presence of God dwelt. And only the high priest could come in once a year offering up the sacrifice that was prescribed. The blood put on the mercy seat covering the sins of the nation for the entire year on the Day of Atonement. So this picture here of Moses. Now, the Lord spoke to Moses, chapter 8, saying, "Speak to Aaron and say to him, when you arrange the lamps, the seven lamps shall give light in front of the lampstand." Now this golden lampstand, which was beaten all out of one piece of gold, that stood about, about yay high, 4 feet off the ground, and it branched off into 5 feet off the ground, and it branched off into the seven branches. You had a picture here of in the holy place, this thing was to be lit, but all the lampstands, all the light, and in the Hebrew construction is kind of strange here. It says, "Give light in front of the lampstand." When we were there at the treasuries of the Temple Institute in Israel, they had each of the lamps pointed inward toward the actual center. And we asked about this, and they said, well, the construction of the Hebrew makes us feel that everything was pointed toward the center, and this idea of giving light in front of the lampstand was, it wasn't just projected outward as it was much projected toward itself. When you go to Revelation and you see the Lord walking in the midst of the seven-branched candlestick, you get this picture. Now it's representing the church, the seven churches of Asia. And the church is the light to the world. And Jesus is walking in their midst. And their place as a church is spoken about as being a part of this lampstand. And it's a very interesting picture. It's why we have behind us the menorah. People ask about the menorah and they think, well, gee, you know, are you celebrating Hanukkah? You know, what goes on here? It's not the nine-branch candlestick. It's not to be confused with that. It's the seven-branched one that you'll see in representing Israel, but it's also representing the church. So that's why we have that. And the nine one is the Hanukkah candlestick, representing a whole different feast, the Feast of Purim for the nation Israel. So this is the seven-branch candlestick, and how this particular style up here, it's believed as the best representation of how it looked, not in detail. This is a very undetailed type of a thing, but at least the shape of it and its direction. And the reason that we can understand that's how it's possibly together is because there are certain frescoes and certain things when the Romans actually took possession of the implements of the temple. They recorded everything very meticulously in their records. And there are actually pictures of some of the things in stone of what they took captive. And this style of menorah is on one of the actual stones. You can go over into Israel today in Capernaum. They have a synagogue that was uncovered there. And you've got one of those Roman stones there. And this particular menorah and the Ark of the Covenant is put on these various carts, and they're taken captive into Babylon. So it's kind of a fascinating thing. But I guess you have to be into seven-branch candlesticks to really get into that. So we'll move on. Aaron did so. He arranged the lamps to face toward the front of the lampstand as the Lord commanded Moses. And this workmanship of the lampstand was of hammered gold. From its shaft to its flowers, it was hammered work according to the pattern which the Lord had shown Moses. So he made the lampstand. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Take the Levites from among the children of Israel and cleanse them ceremonially. Thus you shall do to them to cleanse them." So now they need to be set apart for service. The tabernacle's finished. The offerings are given. Now these Levites who are going to perform the work of the service along with the priests need to be separated, need to be prepared for their work. How they're prepared? This is how. To cleanse them, sprinkle them with the water of purification on them, let them shave all their body and let them wash their clothes and so make themselves clean. Let them take a young bull with his grain offering, a fine flour mixed with oil, and you shall take another young bull as a sin offering and bring the Levites before the tabernacle of meeting, and you shall gather together the whole assembly of the children of Israel. Now, it's just kind of an interesting, I kind of think this way, but if you were a visitor to Israel and you saw one of these shaven people, you know, their heads shaved, everything shaved, all the hair of their body shaved off, and you go, "What is that?" You know, you'd hear this, you know, "Well, that person is separated, you know, unto the Lord as a special service unto the Lord." And then you'd see this straggly looking guy with hair down to his ankles, you know, if he was a Nazirite for that long, and he would look totally unkempt, totally unshaven, and you'd go, "Well, what is that?" And you'd hear, "Well, that is a man who is separated unto the Lord and sanctified it." And you might get a little confused. They had different vows and they had different expressions of it. So whether you have long hair or short hair is a consecration unto the Lord. However you wear your hair, it should be unto the Lord, I guess. You know, to get the picture here. Oh, Lord, let's move on. Verse 10. "So you shall bring the Levites before the Lord, and the children of Israel shall lay their hands on the Levites. And Aaron shall offer the Levites before the Lord as though a wave offering from the children of Israel, that they may perform the work of the Lord. The Levites shall lay their hands on the heads of the young bulls, and you shall offer one as a sin offering, the other as a burnt offering to the Lord to make atonement for the Levites. And you shall stand the Levites before Aaron and his sons and offer them as though a wave offering to the Lord. Thus you shall separate the Levites from among the children of Israel, and the Levites shall be mine." Now, it's a reiteration there in verse 15 through verse 19 of that which we looked at already about the Levites being separated unto the Lord. They were taken in place of the firstborn. The Levites go into the service of the tabernacle of meeting, so cleanse them and offer them as though a wave offering, for they're wholly given to me from among the children of Israel. I have taken them for myself instead of all who open the womb, the firstborn of all the children of Israel. For all the firstborn among the children of Israel are mine, both man and beast, on the day I struck all the firstborn in the land of Egypt. I sanctified them to them myself. Now, when the Lord speaks these things, and to us it gets highly repetitive, what do you think that had as far as an effect on the children of Israel? See, there is a way to learn, and that is by repetition. A good teacher will use repetition when he is instructing children to repeat things over and over again, and eventually it sinks through. Because they say you only remember about 10% of what you hear. So if you hear it 10 times, then you'll remember all of it by the time you hear it 10 times. So repetitive teaching is an important thing. Now, I'll try not to repeat these things over 10 times, because sometimes we can say, "Okay, I've got the point now. I've figured that out. You know, the Levites are the Lord's in lieu of the firstborn." But the Lord uses this principle all the way through the Scripture, highly repetitive. When we get to the book of Deuteronomy, He's going to reiterate everything we've seen in Exodus and Leviticus. And it's called the second law. He reiterates it, only he speaks it kind of a past tense type of a thing. And so the people are constantly getting the same thing, and they're remembering this because every young child that was born in Israel, by the time he was 12 years old, he could almost know word for word the first five books of Moses because of the repetitive nature and how it was done. Now, learning it in the Hebrew, I understand, is a little bit easier because of the way it's constructed and the form and the poetry of it. It's easier to commit to memory than it would be in the English, but the repetitive nature of it is very important. So the Lord repeats, I have taken the Levites instead of all the firstborn of the children of Israel, and I've given the Levites as a gift to Aaron and his sons from among the children of Israel to do the work for the children of Israel in the tabernacle of meeting and to make atonement for the children of Israel, that there be no plague among the children of Israel when the children of Israel come near the sanctuary. Thus Moses and Aaron and all the congregation of the children of Israel did to the Levites according to all the Lord had commanded Moses concerning the Levites, so the children of Israel did to them, and they purified themselves, washed their clothes. Aaron presented them as though a wave offering before the Lord, and Aaron made atonement for them to cleanse them. After that, the Levites went in to do their work in the tabernacle of meeting before Aaron and his sons, as the Lord commanded Moses concerning the Levites, so they did to him them. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, this is what pertains to the Levites. From 25 years old and above, they perform service in the work of the tabernacle of meeting, and at the age of 50 years, they must cease performing this work and shall work no more. So retirement came a little early, and primarily from this particular service, because what these Levites did was basically carry a lot of this, you know, stuff moving from place to place. It was hard, rigorous work. And in those days, if you're over 50, you weren't expected to do it. But you did have a great retirement plan in verse 26. They may minister with their brethren in the tabernacle of meeting to attend to the needs, but they themselves shall do no work. Thus you shall do to the Levites regarding their duties. So you did still have the opportunity to serve in a capacity without doing the actual hard physical labor. That was your lot. That was your calling. You were born a Levite. That was your responsibility. You had a special service unto the Lord from the age of 25 to 50. That was what you were to do. Now the Lord spoke to Moses in the wilderness of Sinai in the first month of the second year after they come out of the land of Egypt, saying, let the children of Israel keep the Passover at its appointed time. And the 14th day of this month, at twilight, you shall keep it at its appointed time. According to all its rites and ceremonies, you shall keep it. And Moses told the children of Israel that they should keep the Passover. So now a year has come by from the time they've been in the wilderness. They're still in Sinai. They're going to be leaving shortly, but they're going to celebrate their first Passover. They kept the Passover then on the 14th day of the first month at twilight in the wilderness of Sinai, according to all the Lord had commanded Moses, so the children of Israel did. There were certain men, however, who were defiled by a body of a dead man. Maybe one of their relatives died, but however it was, they had to carry this dead body, and so now they were ceremonially unclean. And they couldn't keep the Passover on that day. And they came before Moses and Aaron that day, and the men said, hey, we became defiled by a dead body of a man. Why are we kept from presenting the offering of the Lord at his appointed time among the children of Israel? In other words, hey, why can't we keep the Passover? So Moses said, stand still, and I'll hear what the Lord will command concerning you. So the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the children of Israel, saying, if any of you or your posterity is unclean because of a dead body, or is far away on a journey, he may still keep the Lord's Passover. On the 14th day of the second month at twilight, they may keep it. So you kind of get delayed 30 days, but the Lord still accounts it, because now he's giving you the opportunity to keep it on the next month. And he reiterates, they can keep it. They may shall keep it with unleavened bread and bitter herbs. They'll leave none of it till morning, or break one of its bones. According to all the ordinances of the Passover, they shall keep it. But the man who is clean and is not on a journey and ceases to keep Passover, that same person shall be cut off from among his people, because he did not bring the offering of the Lord at its appointed time. That man shall bear his sin. And if a stranger sojourns among you and would keep the Lord's Passover, he must do so according to the rite of the Passover, according to its ceremony. You shall have one ordinance both for the stranger and the native of the land. You remember the whole picture of the Passover was celebrating the Lord delivering his people out of Egypt. The blood of the lamb that was put on the doorpost and the angel of death that passed over God's people in the land of Egypt, so that the firstborn were not killed. All those who did not put the blood on the doorpost in unbelief, or you know, weren't of the children of Israel, they had no care to the or concern of the ordinances of God, the firstborn of every family died. And that great night was a great mourning, great cry and outcry in Egypt as all these firstborn were killed. And at that point, it was when Egypt thrust out Israel and said, leave. And Pharaoh let Israel go, and they left. So it's a celebration even to this day. Now, we're coming up on the time of the celebration of Passover, and it's a very fascinating thing if you get an opportunity to go to a Seder. We've had little demonstrations here before. I think Glenn is doing something with the homeschool group. If you get, I don't know if it's open to everybody. Is it open to everybody, Joe? Glenn, where are you, Glenn? Is that open for everybody? Just talk to Glenn, and you can get an. Maybe he'll give you your own private Seder, you know, if you want. But he'll give you a picture of all the details of things that they do. So much, even in the traditions of the Jewish people, fascinatingly, have its picture in the cross of Jesus Christ and the death of Jesus, and every detail is very fascinating. Even those things that didn't come from the Bible necessarily, but come from traditions, still there's a picture of Jesus Christ in them, and it's a fascinating thing. It's like the Lord is just embedding in them, you know, all these pictures of the Messiah, the suffering Messiah. And yet still they don't see as a nation, but one day they will. On the day of the tabernacle was raised up, the cloud covered the tabernacle, the tent of the testimony, from evening until morning, and it was above the tabernacle like the appearance of fire. And it was always, the cloud covered it by day and the appearance of fire by night. We looked at this in detail as in the morning session as we picture this whole aspect of God making His presence known through this cloud, which had a revelation of His majesty, but also a concealing of it. Kind of like covering it so that they could see it, because no one could stand in the unapproachable light and power of the Lord and not survive. So the Lord mercifully covers His glory so that they can partake of it. And the cloud, this Shekinah glory, is the picture here upon the tabernacle, is the appearance of it. And whenever the cloud was taken up from the tabernacle, the children of Israel would journey. So they follow the cloud through the wilderness, and the place where the cloud settled, the children of Israel would pitch their tents. At the command of the Lord, they journey. At the command of the Lord, they camp. And as long as the cloud stayed above the tabernacle, they remained and camped. When the cloud continued long, many days above the tabernacle, the children of Israel kept the charge of the Lord and did not journey. And so it was when the cloud was above the tabernacle a few days. They, according to the commandment of the Lord, they'd remain and camped. According to the command of the Lord, they'd journey. So this idea here of this cloud, you had to be very sensitive to its leading. If you pulled up your tent stakes to follow it, and it stopped, and you settled down there, and it left another 2 minutes, you know, you'd have to get up another 2 minutes and go, and keep following it. If it stayed for a year in the same place, you had to get comfortable there. That was a part of your life. You waited on the cloud, which really represented the very presence of God. So it was when the cloud remained only from evening till morning, when the cloud was taken up from the morning, they would journey, whether by day or night. Whatever the cloud was taken up, they would journey, whether it was 2 days, a month, or a year. The cloud remained above the tabernacle. The children of Israel would remain encamped and not journey, but when it was taken up, they would journey. At the command of the Lord, they'd remain encamped. At the command of the Lord, they journeyed, and they kept the charge of the Lord at the command of the Lord by the hand of Moses. Now the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, make two silver trumpets for yourself, and you'll make them of hammered work. I don't have a picture of the trumpets. They do have in the temple treasuries a number of trumpets, silver trumpets that were donated in hopes that one day they will have their temple rebuilt and they will be able to use these silver trumpets for the purpose that is described here in this chapter. When they blow both of them, all the assembly shall gather before you at the door of the tabernacle of meeting. But if they blow only one, then the leaders of the heads of the division of Israel shall gather to you. When you sound the advance, so a specific trumpet sound, the camp that lies on the east side shall then begin their journey. So that would have been where Judah would have been stationed, on the outside of the door of the tabernacle, closest to the entrance. And the tribes that were with him, they would have started their advance. And when you sound the advance the second time, then the camps that lie in the south side shall begin their journey, and they shall sound the call for them to begin their journey. When the congregation is to be gathered together, you'll blow, but not sound the advance. The sons of Aaron, the priests, shall blow the trumpets, and these shall be to you an ordinance forever throughout your generations. So, you know, very detailed instruction. If you imagine 3 million people, how are you going to communicate to them without sound, amplification? How are they going to understand what they're supposed to do? Can you imagine leading that many people? Going out to Times Square when there's just a million people there on New Year's Eve and try to get everybody's attention to listen to you say something or give instructions, you know. Good luck. You know, it would be incredible. It'd be difficult. So they had the trumpet sound to give them the picture what they were to do. When they heard it, they knew exactly what they were to do. When you go to war also in your land against the enemy who oppresses you, then you'll sound an alarm with the trumpets and you'll be remembered before the Lord your God. You will be saved from your enemies. So this is kind of like a dual purpose, not only to inform them, but to call upon the Lord. And when the Lord hears the sound of the trumpet and you're in need, the Lord hears. It kind of like, you ever seen those Chronicles of Narnia? You know, there's a picture there of the horn that one of the girls is given and is told, this horn is a magic horn. Anytime you need me, just blow this horn and help will come from someplace to get you out of your bind. And so it's probably a little different picture, but similar. You know, the Lord is saying, hey, I'll be there. I'll remember. You'll be remembered before the Lord. It'd be great to have one of those trumpets. And actually, we don't need a trumpet. We call upon the Lord and He hears us. Also, in the day of your gladness, in your appointed feasts, at the beginning of your months, you'll blow the trumpets over your burnt offerings and over the sacrifices of your peace offerings, and they shall be a memorial for you before your God. I am the Lord your God. Now it came to pass on the 12th day of the second month in the second year that the cloud was taken up from above the tabernacle of the testimony. Now this is a very new event for them. Here they've gotten everything settled in. They've been there for some time. They've got the tabernacle completed. They've had their first sacrifices given. And now the 20th day of the second month in the second year, the cloud was taken up from above the tabernacle of the testimony. And the children of Israel set out from the wilderness of Sinai on their journeys. Then the cloud settled down in the wilderness of Paran. So they started out for the first time according to the command of the Lord by the hand of Moses. The standard of the camp of the children of Judah set out first, according to their armies. Over their army was Nashon, the son of Amminadab, and over the army of the tribe of the children of Issachar was Nethiel, and etc. You see the various standards, the various leaders. Verse 21, then the Kohathites set out carrying the holy things, and the tabernacle would be prepared for their arrival. So by the time the Kohathites got there, because you imagine 3 million people traveling, the first set gets there carrying all the implements of the tabernacle that are going to be constructing it. They're constructing it while the Kohathites are still traveling. By the time the Kohathites get there, the tabernacle is already completed. They just put the stuff right on in. The standard of the camp of the children of Ephraim, verse 22, then set out. And, you know, that was a particular standard. Then the standard, verse 25, of the children of Dan, which formed the rear guard of all the camps, they set out. And verse 29, then Moses said to Hobab, the son of Reuel, the Midianite, Moses' father-in-law, we are setting out for the place of which the Lord said, I will give to you. Now think about where Moses is coming from. In his mind, they're just going, he knows how far it is. He knows it's just 11 days' journey. He doesn't know how long the Lord is going to take them as far as maybe the stops that he will plan. But from his standpoint, he's not far from that place. And so he's telling Hobab, hey, why don't you set out with us? We're going to a great place. Come with us and we'll treat you well. For the Lord has promised good things to Israel. And he said to him, I will not go, but I will depart to my own land and to my own kinsmen. So Moses said, please do not leave, inasmuch as you know how we are to camp in the wilderness, and you can be our eyes. Now, he's not asking for him to guide them, because the cloud is going to do that. But he can know what's beneficial in each place. They stop at a particular place. Hobab could say, hey, you know, I know a great little stream over here you could get water from. Or I know, you know, a great place we can get some mountain goats for dinner. You know, I mean, he knows what's going on. And so Moses is kind of saying, hey, hang around with us. So Moses said, you know, you can be our eyes, and it shall be if you go with us. Indeed, it shall be that whatever good the Lord will do to us, the same will do to you. Now, it doesn't say whether he went with them. We do learn, however, that he did from a later passage. You see his name mentioned, that he more than likely took up his journey. you know, it was probably maybe his first inclination was wiser not to go with them, because he has no idea what he's going to get himself into as the Lord has to discipline his people for 40 years. So maybe his first inclination was wiser. The Lord was saying, no, you don't want to go around with my kids right now. I've got a lot of training to do for them. It'd be kind of like my children's friends coming over when my children are under discipline. It wouldn't be too fun for them. You know, they'd have to sit in their room too, or whatever the punishment was. So Hobab, you know, probably not a good idea to travel with these guys right now. But in a way, here is a picture almost of, you know, a type of the gospel being presented. You see, God's people are a special people. They do have special privileges. And Hobab has an opportunity to join them and also partake of the rewards. So I see in this a type of the gospel for him, in the same way that we have the same type of a way that to invite people to come and hear the gospel of Jesus Christ, to know these things, to know the truth, to have salvation. What an incredible opportunity. So they departed from the mountain of the Lord on a journey of 3 days, and the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord went before them for 3 days' journey to search out a resting place for them. And the cloud of the Lord was above them by day when they went out from the camp. And so it was, whenever the Ark set out, that Moses said, "Rise up, O Lord, let your enemies be scattered, and let those who hate you flee before you." And when it rested, he said, "Return, O Israel, to the many thousands of Israel."